Blog Talk Radio.
Well,
I'm going to let you go ahead and hit the thing so it plays, right? Or do I just start talking?
All right. Shoot. Here we go.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, co-host, and sound engineer, Stephen Gordon.
Well, I don't know that I should accept that title, Phil, because, I mean, you know, a true sound engineer would have been sitting there on the button when the music didn't play, he would have hit it. But we got the music this time.
I think that a few seconds delay is better than me trying to sing it, which is what we did last week.
as long as we don't both try to sing it, you know.
We know we can't do it together, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But we can, I guess, as long as we don't listen. It's like take the headphones off and somebody say, okay, you guys start, we'd probably be all right. But so something's got set wrong, right? Somewhere inside the workings of the of our switchboard, I must have messed things up someplace where it's not automatically starting that. It's got to be me. It's got to be my fault because I've been running all these extra shows.
You know what I just did? I reset it as the start music just now.
Oh,
it was not set as the start music, and so that. Anyway, we want to apologize to our audience. Our start music was not automated on the last couple shows. Now it's back on and. So next show, it ought to just pop.
It ought to go just fine. But as you know, if you're a longtime listener of Fast Forward Radio, or let me tell you for the first time, if this is your first time listening, we have a tradition of a weekly technical glitch, and we've just had the same one 2 weeks in a row. That's all. So, you know, it's sometimes we play the same song twice. So sometimes we have the same glitch twice. I think that's, it's part of the tradition, of Fast Forward Radio. Speaking of traditions, do we have the chat room going? Am I...
We do now. You know what the problem is, Phil? We were having too good of a conversation prior to the show. And,
well, we got talking about the old-timey Speculist back on speculist.com, where we used to run the blog when it had a completely different two layouts prior to the one that we currently have, which is where the content that is kind of our outline for tonight comes from, and I think you kind of got enjoying reading those old blog posts, and
yeah,
heck, one thing led to another, you know.
That's right. That's 7 years we've been doing Fast Forward Radio, and guess who's in the chat room? Sally is in the chat room. So,
oh, hi,
welcome,
Sally.
Welcome, Sally, to the show. We're glad to have you, and sorry we didn't launch the chat room sooner. But anyway, yeah, we've been doing
the Speculist for 7 years.
Launched it, Phil. You launched it, Phil, in the summer of 2003, right?
That's right. Yeah, August of 2003.
And I joined you writing at the Speculist that fall, and then we've pretty much been doing it ever since. And
I think we did our first Fast Forward Radio probably about a year later, right? Late 04,
yeah.
Early 05, something like that.
It was
right?
Actually early 05, because you remember I talked with you about doing the show at the Rocky Mountain Blogger Conference in late 04, and we got around to doing it, I think, in the spring of 05. And that was the year, apparently, that podcasting was invented, and we were doing it and didn't know it was a podcast.
Right.
And so,
well, we invented podcasting is what your bottom line.
I would like to think that, but anyway.
You know how Daily Pundit, he invented the word blogosphere? We didn't invent the word podcast, okay? We invented podcasting on this show. That's the point, okay?
Anyway, you know what was funny was what we would do is we would have a telephone conversation, and I would record my side of the conversation, and you, Phil, on your side. This, I mean, think of this. There was no software at all to support what we were trying to do. So we'd have a phone conversation. I'd record my half of the conversation. You'd record yours on your side, and then we'd merge the two MP3s together.
Yes.
You know, and to make a show, and that was always fun.
Yeah,
and
we would count down together, and theoretically they would sync, but when you sync them up, it wouldn't be quite right. Plus, once you started editing at that level, we were really monsters for, like, getting all the uhs out, and, like, anything we said that we thought sounded dumb, we would take those out, right? So,
it turned into, like, a five-hour editing project for every single show. And so we were doing good to get one show out a month, and that went on for like 10 or 12 shows, and then finally we realized, hey, you know, there's actually software out there. There's people that are doing this, and you know, you can get on a site and do it. And
and for a while we were using a pay service. I can't remember the name of it, but then we Blog Talk Radio showed up, and the rest is just magical history. It's just, you know.
Hey, you know, and I probably this is a whole lot more interesting to us than anybody else. But anyway.
Well, I beg to differ. I'm sure everyone listening is fascinated by the history of the program. But anyway, if you want more of this, if you were only beginning to scratch your itch for the early days of Fast Forward Radio, I'll remind you that Monday evenings we are playing the Fast Forward Radio archives. We've been dipping into those very first shows, and it's really fun listening to both the similarities and the differences between what we do now and what we did even just a few years ago. Just as you can look back at the Speculist 5-6 years ago and see big differences, but also a lot of the same ideas. In fact,
you know, as far as the flavor, I would say there's slightly more wide-eyed optimists probably in the beginning of Fast Forward Radio. What do you think, Phil? Do you think we're more or less optimistic these days?
You know, I think I'm as optimistic as I always was. I do think we temper it better now. I think we remember to talk about the other side and the risks and the downsides and dangers probably better than we did initially. Still optimist, but not as starry-eyed, I guess.
And probably it comes down to this. When we were first starting Fast Forward Radio, we were, you know, a lot of these ideas were so new that, you know, we were like explaining, you know, what transhumanism was to people who had never heard that term. We were talking about technological singularity to people, you know. Obviously we didn't invent those things, but I mean, we were explaining it and popularizing these ideas to an audience that may have never heard of these things. Now we kind of assume our audience, you know, the average guy on the street just about knows those things, so we don't have to be such boosters of those anymore. We can kind of, you know, I think we can look at it and say, yeah, these are ideas that are out there, but we can look at both the positives and negatives and maybe
And going with that same idea, the other thing we can do is we can compare and contrast. There are now multiple competing models, sometimes conflicting, sometimes overlapping, sometimes complementary, but lots of different ideas about these things. And so you can spend more time comparing one versus the other rather than saying, oh, here's what the singularity is.
Right.
There are a lot of different ideas.
Yeah,
about the singularity.
Which singularity are you talking about? There's about 20 versions at least. So, you know, exactly. That's,
yeah. So, anyway, some of the content from 7 years ago turns out to be still perfectly, perfectly good and perfectly usable, and we're going to be revisiting one of the first posts I ever did at The Speculist as part of our Thanksgiving special this evening. Now, for our non-U.S. listeners, this is Thanksgiving weekend coming up in a couple of days here in the U.S., Thursday and Friday. Our days off for almost everyone. Thursday is a national holiday, and then Friday is kind of an unofficial national holiday. Most of the schools are closed. Schools, I think, are just about uniformly closed. Is that fair to say? Have you ever heard of a school open the Friday after Thanksgiving?
No,
I haven't either.
But I mean, if you're going to travel to see Grandma, how are you going to get back in time for school on Friday? You know, I mean,
exactly.
So
can't be done. So by and large, everyone has a 2-day. It's really kind of our only official. Although it's not official, But it's the only real two-day holiday we have, because you got Thanksgiving, and then the next day is Black Friday, again, unofficial beginning of the Christmas shopping season, which used to be the earliest possible date for which you could put up Christmas decorations or play Christmas music on the radio. But both of those have been significantly violated in recent years. I don't know if you've noticed that. So the
I have.
The interesting overlap is that now Thanksgiving is like the early part of the Christmas season. It's not the thing that comes right before the Christmas season. It's sort of like, oh, the Christmas season starts and you have Thanksgiving as part of the beginning of that, and then it sort of carries on.
We basically have people, they pull down the Halloween decorations and put up the Christmas decorations now. It's funny.
It pretty much goes that way. But I want to talk about the idea of Thanksgiving. I think it's great that it's an American holiday, and I know that other countries have Thanksgiving as well. In Canada, they had it back in October, and I'm sure a lot of countries have a day set aside for giving thanks, for being grateful. And I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal today, actually yesterday. It was actually on the blogs, although it links to a longer and more detailed article. But the name of the article was Gratitude, the Wonder Drug. And it's just talking about kind of the mental health benefits that accrue when you keep as we've called this week's installment of the show, an attitude of gratitude. That apparently just taking that approach to life makes your life longer. It helps you sleep better. It gives you more satisfaction in life. You tend to be less susceptible to infectious disease. There's a whole host of tremendous personal and health benefits that accrue to those who take some time to be grateful, or I guess who kind of orient their lives around gratitude. And I'm a big believer in it. I think that that we should stop and think about, by and large, for most of us, how good we've got it, because we really do have it amazingly good. That's part of the whole message of the Speculist, part of the whole message of accelerating change and the human imperative, is that we've been working a long time towards making things better, and where we are right now, we're kind of the beneficiaries of a long process of our ancestors working to make the world better. They were making it better for themselves and for their families, and in some sense they were doing it for us. So I think we ought to appreciate that. When someone does you a good turn like that, it's only good manners, I think, to feel grateful. If you want to feel grateful to God, I think that's a great idea too. But this is not strictly speaking a religious thing. You can be grateful even if you aren't necessarily a religious person. In fact, I've got a couple of quotes that I'd like to share. Here's a quote from someone we've had on the program, and he's writing about this interesting trend of accelerating change and increasing complexity. And he says, "What is perhaps even more interesting is that this appears to be a natural, universally permissive process, facilitated by the special structure of the physics of the microcosms, small scales of matter, energy, space, and time. Join us in an ongoing critical dialogue on what may be the single most important issue of the human era," talking about this accelerating change. And he concludes the essay with, "What an amazing time to be alive." Do you know who wrote that?
Sounds like something you wrote, Phil.
No, well, thank you very much. Actually, John Smart wrote that.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
So John Smart, I think, would agree with us that one ought to appreciate the circumstances we find ourselves in. Now, here's another quote. This is an individual who has never been on our program, unfortunately passed away before we started doing Fast Forward Radio, but we've had his voice on, and in fact, we've had his voice saying these words: "How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds." Now, you know who that is.
Oh, yes, Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan. So,
I would have loved to have had him on Fast Forward Radio. His death,
well,
his
that's why we've had him on so many times. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
He was a man truly ahead of his time. You know, when you look at the book Cosmos, especially the original big picture book version of it that had the graphics in it, the pictures in it, a lot of those are interesting kind of forerunner precursors to some stuff we see later from Kurzweil. Carl Sagan really kind of helped push us in that direction. But I love this quote from him: "How lucky we are to live in this time," and echoed there by John Smart in 2003, and by us here in 2010. It's a great privilege to exist at all. When you consider the odds against any of us actually being here, the odds against anything being here, and much less the odds of us personally being here, it's cool to exist, as I think I've mentioned in the past. But more cool to exist in a world where we have such tremendous potential and such tremendous opportunities to know things, to do things, to explore the universe, to explore our own lives in ways that even a few years ago weren't available to people. So I think it's important, not just from a health standpoint, but from a, you know, getting oriented around your life correctly standpoint. It's important to just step back and think about all that there really is to appreciate about our lives, all there is to really be grateful for and to be thankful for. And with that in mind,
I wanted to add another quote. Sir Isaac Newton had a famous rivalry with Robert Hooke, and in a moment of generosity, he sent a letter to his rival, and he said, "You have added much in several ways. If I have standing on the shoulders of giants," and I think he was basically saying, "You're one of the giants that I was able to stand upon," even in that early, I mean, that's really at the dawn of science, modern science in a way, and he's already talking about having the privilege of standing on the shoulder of giants at that time. And so, you know, we're standing on many more shoulders since then.
Yeah, we get to stand on Newton's shoulders, for heaven's sake, and all the all those individuals who've come since him, including Carl Sagan, right, whose shoulders we're standing on in reflecting on his quote. It's absolutely that's a great quote from him. There's another one of his. Actually, we won't go there. But we'll talk about it when it's appropriate. But I do love that that quote from Isaac Newton. Thanks for sharing that one. So here's what I thought we'd do, Stephen. Let's we're reviewing the extremely good news. This was a post that I put up on the Speculist, as I believe I already mentioned, September 29th. 2003, so more than 7 years ago. And what I did was I just tried to put together a list of the progress that we're making, the really awesome things that we can expect to see happen in the coming years, possibly in our own lifetimes. The things that have moved dramatically within the possibility space of humanity over the last few years, or maybe over the last few centuries, depending on what perspective you want to give it. So I don't have any particular approach to how we want to go through the list. I don't think we want to read the whole thing. Stephen, does as you look at it, do any of the items jump out at you? Anything on the list that you want to talk about?
Well, you know, you had asked me just prior to the show, what of these things have we seen significant progress in? And I would say that pretty much anything dealing with computation, whether it having access to technology and knowledge for all who want it, that's number four under standards of living in your list there. Access to technology and knowledge for all who want it. I think we've seen in that. And then in another place you mentioned virtual reality. Pretty much any of these fields that are directly tied to computation, we've seen massive movement in. The less direct the tie to, you know, computation of these things, the slower the progress, I would say. And of course, everything in the world just about is tied to computation now. But for example, you put here eradication of hunger worldwide. Well, no, we've not seen that. In fact, the recession, maybe small D depression we're going through right now in this country, we actually have seen some hunger locally. But you know, it's you know we've there's been progress, though, medical progress in the last 7 years in other areas as well. So, I mean, yeah, we've seen lots of progress in some of these areas, and then other areas we have seen some disappointments. So, you know.
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at these, and they do get more far out as you work your way down the list. I mean, they're within a given category, right? So
yeah,
when you look at preserving and nurturing the biosphere, we start with methods of production that generate zero pollutants and energy sources that produce zero pollutants. If I were to look at that and say, are we closer today to those things than we were 7 years ago? I'd say, absolutely, we are. Absolutely, because those are known problem spaces that are being worked on. And we've heard about really interesting new thoughts on both how to produce materials and how to produce energy without damaging the environment. There's been a huge thrust in that direction. Now, ironically, some of the things that are touted as green energy, as things that are good energy sources that are conducive to the environment, actually aren't that great for the environment. One of the really interesting chapters in The Rational Optimist deals with that very thing, just the fact that, well, you know, wind power, for example, you end up killing a lot of birds and you end up, deforesting a lot of places. Also true with if you're using palm oil to produce biofuels. So
using corn for ethanol is probably the worst, but...
Well,
you know.
That's bad because it's arguable, highly debatable whether it produces any net energy. So,
right.
So it might fail on whether it's even an energy source to begin with. But as far as producing pollutants go, it seems to cause its share of environmental damage. Plus, it cuts into the food supply. So that's
like dumb in three different ways. It's just not the only reason that we continue to do it at all is subsidies. Any policy wonks out there that have some connection with a congressman or a senator, you might want to just put a bug in their ear.
Or for all the congressmen and senators listening, I guess we should talk directly to them.
Absolutely.
You guys, seriously, and ladies, please.
Yeah, it's a dumb idea. Don't do that.
Knock it off with that. I'm not down on alcohol per se. For fuel, I think that you probably want to use different sources. Maybe cellulose. Maybe you want to use some of those beet crops seem to produce a pretty good ethanol. But all told, you're going to end up plowing a lot of acreage that might otherwise have been natural habitat in order to produce that stuff. And if there's another option, if you're interested both in producing energy and in protecting the environment, ethanol is going to be a tough case to make. I think algae starts to look a lot better as a biofuel at that point. And that's one of the really good ones because it produces a tremendous amount of energy, and it's got this zero carbon footprint, right? It's like all the carbon that it reintroduces into the atmosphere is carbon it had already taken out or something. Am I saying that right? Did I just lie about algae, or is that true?
Yeah, the thing about algae is it's a neutral because when it has to absorb carbon as part of the growth process, okay, and then of course it's released when it's burned as fuel, the fuel is burned, but it's zero. Now, you take coal out of the ground and convert it into a liquid fuel, then you burn it in the gas tank of a car, and that's possible, by the way. And we may end up doing it at some point if we really experience something like peak oil. You know, we might actually think about taking coal out of the ground and liquefying it and making some sort of fuel out of it. But of course, then you're releasing carbon that had been sequestered in the form of coal. And I wrote a post about 3 or 4 weeks back about an alternative to that. You can actually take CO2 either out of the atmosphere or out of the emissions of a power plant or any kind of plant really, and you can use that to make your fuel. And so you're sequestering the carbon into your fuel, then it's burned and released again, but it's neutral, just like using the algae. So to the extent you want to avoid CO2, at least use something that's neutral.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, if we end up doing something like that, and those are possibilities, it's a very real possibility that we do algae, that, things take a bad turn and we end up using coal. To me, that would be a bad turn. I mean, it would be necessary, and it's not like I'm saying we should never do it. Better that we burn coal than that we halt all technological progress, because I think ultimately cleaning up the environment depends on technological and economic progress. This is where I am at odds with my green friends who think that technological and economic progress are the enemy in the environment. I think that's an understandable position, but I think it misses the point, which is that ultimately technology and abundance are the best friend of the environment.
I would invite your green friends and my green friends as well that have those ideas to visit any poor country you name. Pick a poor country out of a hat and go visit it and tell me how their environment is.
Right. That's right.
And then come back and tell me about that, because the poor countries that I've visited have severe environmental problems by comparison to developed countries. So, yes, absolutely, technology is the way to go to have a cleaner environment. So,
if it came to a choice, I would say, yep, burn coal to keep things going until we can have whatever it's going to be, black light energy or probably something less exotic than that. Ultimately, if you follow Kurzweil's projections, it'll all be solar, right? We'll be running everything off solar eventually, and that truly will be a method of producing energy that is non-polluting and that will, be 100% sustainable. So we will get there, and I think we've seen
solar.
What's that?
I'm just saying space-based solar. That's, you can do space-based solar and then microwave it back to the home. That might be a cool way to do it. So.
Well, see, that's got the added benefit. Not only is it solar, but it's way cool because it's got space involved. And,
yeah, and it's 24 hours a day.
Well, yeah. And you get that too. But I would rank cool right up there with the. but there are outliers. We might figure out things to do with wave energy. We might figure out things to do with geothermal. The great thing is that we know more about ways of producing energy today in 2010 than we did in 2003. There are more good ideas on the table today than there were then. And so, we haven't arrived there, but are we closer? I think there's no question that we're closer to realizing one of those possibilities because we're seeing more of them, and we're seeing progress along numerous axes that will ultimately lead us in that direction. So although we have not arrived at zero pollutant production or zero pollutant energy, we're gonna, I am as convinced today as I was in September of 2003 that we're on our way there, and I feel like we're making progress in that direction. Now, what about some of these others? Preservation of natural habitat for all living species. I don't know. I think we're doing okay on some of this stuff. Actually, human population levels with zero negative environmental impact. You know what? I think we're probably closer to that one than we realize. We're probably closer to that one with the massive population we have today than we were 50, 60 years ago with a population only half as large as what we currently have. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think one thing that's important that's being done now is, we've covered this ground a couple times here recently. What can't be measured can't be improved.
Right.
Okay. And here recently, we have, we as a world have begun cataloging species to a much greater extent than ever before. His name has slipped my mind. Binter is gone throughout the world cataloging species that we had never known before. You could go out in the ocean and drop a bucket in the water and pull in a bucket of water and you can discover a bunch of microorganisms that had never been cataloged before. And that's basically he went throughout the world doing that, you know, just microorganisms. So,
that's awesome.
And you know, so we know a whole lot more about the species that we have in the Earth. And so if we know more about these species and, you know, what they do and what they're, you know, what niches they are in, maybe we can protect them and or at least stay out of their way to some extent if we're able to. So, yeah, I mean, we know a lot more, and that helps.
So. I think so. I think it definitely helps. You know, being aware of it and working on it are tremendously helpful. And there are nonprofits that are set up to protect certain endangered species. Although that's been going on for quite some time. That was a big push in the U.S. even starting as early as probably the late 60s, early 70s. And it gained some momentum in Europe, and now it's global. I mean, all countries except for some of the most really, repressive regimes in some developing countries have at least some emphasis on that. It seems like that's a value that most of the world has adopted, that the world had not adopted 50, 60 years ago. So, you know, I think being aware of it, and as you said, having information on it, that makes a huge difference. Okay, well, let's jump on down to standards of living, because you challenged me on eradication of hunger worldwide, and I think you're probably right that progress there has not been sweeping or dramatic. But when I look at that, and I look at adequate clean water, housing, clothing for all, let me put it to you this way. If you had to guess, because we don't have data, we certainly don't have anything like a survey that's going to give you a reasonable answer to this question, so it's unfair. But if you had to guess, do you think that there are more people in the world today who have access to clean drinking water, who have a roof over their head, and who have clothing than there were September 29th, 2003?
Well, there are some technologies that we have now. You remember the Lifesaver bottle that I?
Yes.
One of the things
I'm thinking of, actually.
It is the Lifesaver bottle is. There's a TED Talk that prompted me to go buy this Lifesaver bottle, and. In this TED Talk, he basically says filter bottles in the past would filter for bacteria. You know, you could get a filter bottle that could filter all the bacteria out of it, which is fine until you start, you know, unless you pick up a virus. And viruses could not be filtered in the past. Viruses tend to be about 16, 17, 18 nanometers, and they were filtering things down to maybe, you know, 30 or 40 nanometers. The Lifesaver bottle now filters down to about 10 nanometers, I believe, and so it's catching all the viruses as well as everything else. And so I did a test, and you know, got my Lifesaver bottle, and basically spent probably 2 or 3 weeks, the better part of 2 or 3 weeks, drinking pond water. And I mean, not the sort of pond. I mean, it really, it's kind of a nasty looking pond, it looks like it's fed by a swamp, okay? I mean, it's not, you know, it's just not something you would want to drink. But I drank that pond water as filtered through the Lifesaver bottle, and it was just like drinking bottled water. It did not have any kind of smell or bad taste or anything, and I did not get sick. And I just lost interest in the experiment rather than have had some other negative reason for giving.
Well, Stephen, bottom line is you have access to potable water without doing that, right? I mean,
exactly.
You know, if you need a drink of water,
but I wanted to give it a test. I wanted
yeah,
to see.
Yeah, sure.
And,
but I mean, long term, you're gonna you know go.
But the point is,
turn
this
on the
is
tap
a,
or whatever it is you do, you know, hit the fridge, right? But
exactly. The idea, of course, is to put these bottles in the hands of people who don't have potable water, you know.
And let me tell you that's happening. That is happening in the world. There is a quiet revolution going on where clean water is concerned. By the way, for all your Interesting, don't get me wrong, story that you told there, the kind of slow wind-up that you had to answering the question. Sally answered the question with, yes, more people have those things, especially in Asia. So thank you, Sally, for delivering the answer I was actually looking for. But that's okay. This led to a good discussion, too. There's a group, they're called Samaritan's Purse. Have you heard of this organization?
I have, yes.
Yeah, you can, basically you sponsor helping folks out in developing countries. And they publish a catalog around Christmas time, and you can just order things. And one of the things you can order is you can order, like, one of those bottles and just send it to somebody in a place where they need it. Or you can order a big version of that that's good enough for a whole village. And, you know,
yeah, it's
we
like
did
a
jerry
can version of it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we did that. It's like I'm thinking, this is a great example not only of things that have improved, of how we've moved in that direction, but it's also another example of how we're individually empowered to do these things. Because there was a time when you could sit around and wish that you could do something to help people in the third world have clean water, but what are you going to do about it, right? And now it's like it's as easy as, you know, I mean, ordering anything off any catalog. You just say, yeah, I'd like to send one of those bottles to somebody so that their family will have clean water from now on. And Samaritan's Purse is, you know, that's the one I saw. That's the organization whose catalog we used. But there are dozens of groups and individuals and organizations that are making that happen. And through no centralized, concerted effort, clean water is finding its way to people who never had it before, and it's happening at a remarkable pace. It needs to continue to happen, and it needs to happen faster than it's happening. But just that one alone has seen tremendous progress over the last not only 7 years, but over the last 3 or 4 years, because it's something that anyone can do, and a lot of people are excited about that and are taking that offer up. And now that I'm thinking about it, I'm kind of looking forward to doing that again this year, to helping out someone else over there who needs clean water. I mean, it's very cool to think that there's, you know,
and
there's something so simple
there's
you
no
can
reason
do.
Not to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I was just saying it's tax deductible. I mean, you know,
and it's
do it through
tax break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's, why not do it? You know.
Yeah, it's good all the way around.
Yeah.
But actually, I think Sally's right. I think if you look at those other things, not just the clean water, which has the quiet revolution associated with it, but actually housing and clothing, I think, fall under similar circumstances, which is just the massive production of stuff that started really ramping up, I guess, in the late 19th century and has just continued pretty much unabated ever since. There is just more stuff to go around at the end of any given decade, not counting maybe world wars or serious depressions. But if I were a guessing man, I would give the same confident answer Sally gave, which is, yep, more people have clothing and more people have housing. Just because stuff has become more abundant in that period of time, it has become disposable stuff has become more widespread, just cheap, easy to get your hands on, easy to assemble housing materials have become more abundant. So I think that I think we've made progress on all those. Now, what about this next one, though? Medical care for all. What do you think? How's the world treated that one over the last decade and a half?
Well, it's a politically loaded question, isn't it? You know, we've recently in the United States passed a form of a centralized medical care that, of course, has not kicked in yet, but. You know, has that improved anything? Well, I can say with 100% confidence, as of yet, no. it has not gone into effect. I guess the bigger question is, will it? Go into effect, and will it cause any improvement at all? Is that kind of what you're getting at, Phil? I mean,
actually. That's a fine direction to take it. That's interesting that we're on that road. I really wasn't thinking of that per se when I wrote it down. Although I was just with a friend having a conversation about this just a while ago, and it didn't occur to me to make the connection between medical care for all, which to me is right up there with clean water for all, And you're right. This is, you know, that is a slogan, isn't it? Medical care for all is a political slogan. I didn't think of it in political terms. I have to say, when I wrote it 7 years ago, or even when I just read it out loud just a minute ago. But you're right.
Well, but you know what you did do during the height of the Obamacare, debates. You wrote a post about how, you know, technology. Don't want to steal your thunder too much, but I think pretty much the way you came down was, if I was a betting man, I would bet that technology delivers medical care for all before politics does.
Well, and obviously that's what I was thinking when I wrote this post.
Exactly.
Yeah, no. You know, that's how I look at it. In fact, if the question is, do we have more medical care today than we did 7 years ago, I'm betting yes. I think there's a lot more care in the world. And really, when you look at things like the systems that get put in place around it, whether it's regulations on insurance or whether it's full-blown, socialized medicine programs. The question is, from a strictly speculative standpoint, okay, leaving all political ideology aside just for a moment, the real question is, what does that do to the increase in abundance of healthcare? The increase in availability of healthcare? And I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, is that going to produce any more? And that's my big kind of concern about it, is like, well, if you want for there to be more health care, then produce more health care, right? That's kind of how I look at it. And to me, that has to do with probably automating it, providing good incentives for people to go into medicine, providing good incentives for doctors who are already in medicine to provide more care than they currently do. You know, those kinds of things. Those are the things that that will produce more care. If you want for there to be more care, produce more of that.
What you don't want, and this here Stephen goes being political again, okay? But what you don't want,
it's just lucky that you're the one who controls the mute button, huh? I had already shut
you. Exactly. You can't, you can't do anything.
There's nothing I can do. Yeah.
Exactly. So sit back and take it. Anyway,
that's right.
Anyway, you know, what you don't want is a centralized authority basically saying, okay, we only can afford us, you know, this society can only afford a certain number of, name it, whatever procedure it is, and we're only going to pay for this number, therefore we're going to kind of ration it out. And that, of course, has been, you know, one of the rallying cries of those who've been against socialized medicine and our Obamacare in this country. So, anyway.
I think that's right. The way I would put it is, I don't want anything to make the distribution of care less efficient, and I certainly don't want anything that disincents people from going into medicine or that disincents people from developing new means of providing care. Those are like all the things that should be that people should be encouraged to do. So if you have a system, if you have this like government controlled system, and it somehow allows all that, then I'm really okay with it. You know what? I'm like, okay, fine. If you put a government system in place and there's going to be lots more care than there was, then I'm probably okay with it. But you haven't persuaded me that that's what's going to happen, right? That's you know, kind of the downside is I'm persuaded that generally speaking we're going to produce more care, and that we can probably do things to accelerate that, and we can do things to decelerate that. And it looks to me like a centralized government-operated plan decelerates that. It looks to me like it puts the incentives in the wrong place, and it doesn't have its main thrust around producing more care. So when I look at it, I go, it's a bad deal. If I want there to be medical care for everybody, which I do, then I don't want there to be a government-controlled program to implement it, because I think if that gets us there at all, it gets us there a lot more slowly than a system that encourages more rapid and more efficient production of care. That's how I look at it. And I think you didn't mute me either, so I guess we're...
Yeah, well, I was about to say, you came back around to sanity, and so I'm glad I didn't mute you. So anyway.
Actually, I think we're pretty close. I think we're talking about pretty much...
Yeah, I think we're within a hair's breadth of agreeing 100% on that, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway,
We're not there yet, but I actually feel like we're closer than we were 7 years ago, and I feel that 7 years from now we'll be closer than we are today. You know what? 7 years from tonight, or roughly, let's have a call. We'll check in. We'll see where's national health care and do we feel like there's more healthcare in the world than there was? It'll be a good, you know, kind of a check.
Yeah, and I suppose it's two different questions. You know, if our healthcare system has been completely ravished by, you know, stupid policy, it doesn't mean necessarily that there's less good healthcare in the world. The world's a big place, and so, you know, it might be that the United States has taken 5 steps back, but the world is sprinted ahead. You know, so.
Well, the thing is, the bottom line is this is an interesting thing. It could be a total disaster and not work very well at all, and we could still have more healthcare. Because that's kind of the nature of accelerating returns, right?
Yeah,
what that would tell you, though, is that we don't have nearly as good a health care as we would have had, right? I mean, that's kind of different.
For example,
Kurzweil talks about how technology continues to develop even though you go through world wars and you go through the dark ages, and it's this, like, steady progression. It doesn't have to happen, but it's one of the things that it almost feels like you can count on in this world.
Here we are in the middle of this, you know, pretty bad economic downturn. And computers are still getting better and better all the time.
That's right.
You know, and cheap. You know, I mean, you know, it might be that we're not buying the top of the line computers anymore. Seems like you know, last year's model is half as expensive this year, and so, you know, it might be that you buy that, you know, instead of.
Well, yeah, and besides, if you buy one that's not the top of the line, if you buy the middle of the line. From last year, it's still 10 times better than the top of the line from 3 years ago, right? So, I mean,
which is what you probably have sitting on your desk. So you're still taking a big step forward.
Yeah.
You know, every time you go to buy a new computer. You know,
yeah.
So.
As long as medical care gets increasingly wrapped up in digital technology, it will
It might be idiot proof. It might almost be idiot proof to the point that we can't screw it up.
Let's hope so. That is a truly optimistic statement on Thanksgiving. So I second that. Here's to idiot-proof stuff, because we certainly need a good share of that.
I think it's safe to say Phil and I are not big fans of our ruling class. When it comes to, we're bigger fans of the guys that are delivering the technology. So
yeah, I'm sure they're nice and smart people. They just, once you get them into certain contexts, they really, wow.
You know, okay. When we're toasting the founder of the feast, we're not thinking of our, you know, of our congressman. You know,
I don't even, yeah, you know, again, who I'm sure is a nice person, but indeed. Okay. Yeah, maybe I'm just too nice, huh?
Well,
we're going to work on New Year's resolutions here. I'm going to have to take it up, take the nice down a notch, maybe. Okay, let's see. We got time for a couple more of these. Let's see what else is good. How about indefinite human lifespan? That's cool that we just had the rerun of The Age of the Indefinite Lifespan on Saturday. We replayed that show from The World Transformed. Terry Grossman and Aubrey de Grey talking about Dr. Grossman talking about really practical things to some fairly esoteric things, and of course Aubrey with his very well planned, well thought out, systematic approach to how to eliminate aging. So the question is, are we any closer in 2010 than we were in 2003? To indefinite human lifespan? And my answer to that is we absolutely are. And if for no other reason, for the exact reason that you said about protecting species and protecting the environment, we're so much more aware of it now. You got this whole personal metrics, this whole, what is it called, the quantified self movement going on. You've got people in a much more organized and serious way working on the problem than we had 7 years ago. And that in itself means we're closer to a solution because, you know, every day we're learning more about what it means to age. We're learning more about what things are effective in retarding that process. And ultimately we're going to find out what's effective in reversing that process.
Yeah. You know, I've read some here recently, basically arguing that we age in large part as a defense to cancer. You know,
Say that again. I missed what you said there. I'm sorry.
Okay. We age in large part, according to a couple of things I've read here recently, we age in large part as a defense to cancer. If we didn't age, if our body wasn't constantly weeding out cells that just were a little bit off, a little weird, you know, potentially cancerous, and basically putting them in a senescence cycle.
Wow.
That's what the body is doing. We live a long time. We're able to, you know, we put ourselves, we age in order to keep from having cancer. If we weren't aging, you know, 40 of cancer because we're weeding out cancer all the time. Our body is, but in the process, we're killing cells, and that are not replaced. So maybe the answer is we continue to kill off cells and figure out some way to replace them at the same time. So I don't know.
Well, the thing is, you know, number two on the list here was quick, effective treatment for any kind of cancer, and we've talked about this numerous times. Hardly a week goes by, certainly not a month goes by, that you don't see some major new breakthrough in treatment of cancer. I think, of all the things that we've observed on this program and at The Speculist over the last few years, that's the one that I always just sort of keep coming back to and am just astounded by, is that, it feels like there is a major medical breakthrough, something that would have been screaming headlines 30 years ago, happening to very little fanfare about once a week now. And that stuff has got to add up. Ultimately, relationships between these things begin to become important, and underlying causes begin to become important. And when we look at aging as this kind of massive destruction of our cells, you think, well, okay, but you know what? We're making progress on so many different fronts here. It's really hard for me to even imagine that some of this isn't going to become relevant to that. Probably very soon. In fact, I would think, give it another 7 years, and we'll look back and we'll go, well, now we know, and I don't know what it is we'll know, but we'll say now we know for sure that this actually can make you live longer. I mean, it's interesting the things that that are attributed to longevity that I never heard about 7 years ago in that context. 7 years ago, I flossed my teeth because I didn't want to get gum disease, and I still floss my teeth because I don't want to get gum disease. But the realistic serious estimate is that if you floss daily, you add 2 years to your life. Had you heard that?
Yes, I had, and it doesn't, you know, and think about it. Your mouth is really a serious path to all kinds of disease, including heart disease.
Right.
You know, and so if you maintain good dental health, not only will your smile be nicer. You'll also, you're protecting your health in a lot of ways. And, you know, I have noticed people that have poor dental health, they tend to have a lot of other problems, too.
They absolutely do seem to go together. And there's a link, I think you're right, absolutely right, between the mouth being kind of the gateway to the body. And there's also a link between gum disease and inflammation in the body generally. And this is probably the other just concept that we didn't hear much about, I think, a decade ago, and we hear about a lot now. If you read Future Pundit, Randall Parker's blog, there's interesting research being done around inflammation and new findings all the time, and the link between inflammation and various kinds of cancer, between it and diabetes, between it and obesity and heart disease, is indisputable. And what we're learning about how to prevent it and how to treat the things that it causes, I think, are just astounding. It hasn't been systematized yet, so we don't know what the net benefit is. But I think just even just being able to whip out you can add 2 years to your life if you floss your teeth is really a pretty remarkable thing. I don't know of any other 7-year period in history where I could say, yeah, we've added 2 years to human lifespan because we floss our, you know, I mean, because of this very rudimentary, simple hygiene practice, and it makes you think that there's a lot more of those kinds of things that have yet to be uncovered.
There's one I want to cover, Phil, and I think that you may be able to contribute, to this a lot. And that is,
I'll tell you what, Stephen, we'll make this our last one because I know we want to get to our music tonight. So.
Okay, absolutely, absolutely. Full immersion VR to simulate any experience. Well, how about full immersion? Instead of talking about it under recreation, let's talk about it under work. Immersion VR to eliminate distance. Now, I believe your company has rolled out a product that, you know, basically is a television set-top device that, is teleconferencing. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong that it's been rolled out. That's Cisco who did that, though. I work for SAP. So it does exist. SAP, even when we were just Sybase, and we still are Sybase, but as a subsidiary company, even when we were just Sybase, we've used Cisco products for teleconferencing for some time. They have really been the pace setters in a lot of ways around this technology. In terms of video teleconferencing is not what it once was. It's still not full immersion VR. Okay, You still don't go into a room and have the experience of sitting in the same room with someone else. But I think about when I worked for the phone company 20 years ago, and we had powerful cables that we could dedicate to sending these signals across, and this like blippy, unreliable, broken sound, mess that we called, it was just a novelty back in those days, and it was a complete waste of time. Today, you can really sit down and have a discussion with someone and have a meeting with them, and you can share information, you can show each other things, you can talk to each other, and there really is a feeling that you've experienced that person's presence. Now, what Cisco has done, I think, is they have now taken that capability, which was something that belonged to the business world, and now extended that out to everyone. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And I'm seeing that advertised here recently on television a couple of times. They must have just rolled it out in the last couple of weeks or something. It's a set-top device that allows this. It's just a cool thing. Now, I would say, to the extent that that people avoid flying. Maybe because of the lines, maybe because of other reasons, TSA, we're looking at you. It might be that it drives people to adopt these things, meetings will occur this way. Maybe even to some extent, family reunions. You can daily talk to a relative halfway across the country if you need to.
I think it's a convergence of a lot of things. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
The just overarching trend in human history is that we just won't take a distance for an excuse, right? We find ways to be with each other even if people are a long way away, which used to mean sometimes taking these horrendous treks, and now it can mean picking up the phone and calling someone. But that's still not quite their presence. So we all have televisions in our house. We saw TV phones back in 2001, A Space Odyssey, right? I mean, it's a capability that we're supposed to have, and we're getting closer and closer to it, being able to experience more and more of that person's presence. My wife and my daughter, my baby daughter, they call home back to Malaysia every week using Google, video chat, right? And that's not nearly as high def or nearly as good a signal as what you're going to get off that Cisco thing. But it's still a step in that direction. And I think that we're seeing a lot more of that now than we did then, and we're only going to see more of it. So people get some of the music. Let's move to that.
Okay, our music tonight is I Heart Thanksgiving. By The Funk. And just to let you know, this is to the tune of Sister Golden Hair by the band America back in 1975. So without any further ado, let's play it.
All right. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. Thanks to all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, and everyone listening to Fast Forward Radio. We will be back on Saturday, and then we'll be back on three times a week starting next week. So until next time, live to see it.
Well, I tried to make it Monday, but the hailstorm closed O'Hare. So I carjacked me a Hyundai. 19 hours and I'll be there. I've got no more paid vacation, and your family's always rude. But I'll bust my butt to get there for the food. Well, I keep on thinking about your sister's boys and berry pies, and the sweet potato casserole brings teardrops to my eyes. Though there's loads of carbohydrates and the fat gram counts are seen, it's my first excuse to gorge since Halloween. Will you feed me rolls and drumsticks? Will you heap beans on my plate? Will you stuff me till my bum sticks out where your chair can't bear my weight? Though my seams are ripping, I don't mind saying I heart Thanksgiving. Well, I keep on thinking about those Pilgrims 1620 feast. It's their fault that my blood pressure and cholesterol increased. If you want help washing dishes, I've devised a brilliant plan. I'll just fall asleep and blame the tryptophan. Will you feed me till there's nothing? Will you feed me broiler loads? Will you stuff me full of stuffing until my gastric tract explodes? And if I'm still living, I'll keep on saying I heart Thanksgiving.
Hey, go easy on those cranberries, old lady. I haven't had third yet.